Hello and welcome to another episode of I Am the Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by multi-vocalist, musician and creative genius, Darren Foreman, also known as Beardy Man.
Well, that's quite an introduction. I don't think I'm any of those things at all.
None of them.
No, I mean, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I am because I've spent the whole week listening to McCartney 2. And now I don't know who I am anymore. And I don't know what anything means. My childhood has been broken, torn to shreds by this abomination. Let's just get straight into it. Right, listen. Paul McCartney is undoubtedly one of the greatest songwriting geniuses that the world has ever produced.
Yes.
He's one of the greatest musicians of all time, you know, completely self-taught and manages to navigate these really complex songs and melodies and chord changes, you know, effortlessly. He's a genius. He's, you know, one of the most successful songwriters and singers and performers of all time. And this is the worst album of all time. It's so, so poor. It's amazing. It's a thing of wonder.
It is.
It's a pearl.
It is. My challenge today is to try and convince you otherwise.
Well, no. So, right. So, let me be completely clear so there's no ambiguity. Even though this album is objectively terrible, I love it because... to me, I could write a book on it, the zen of listening to bad art, consuming bad art. Because, like, you know, I go to the Edinburgh Festival most years. In fact, most years I've performed at it, and I've not had a chance to see shows because I've been, you know, doing shows there. But the thing I really love about, you know, going there as a punter is that at the Edinburgh Festival, it's the most well-attended performing arts festival in the world, I think. It's mental. It's really hard to sort of get through the crowds and stuff. And you will see every level of performance art, from the truly, truly dire, where every single second of it is so bad that it's almost good, and then to the sort of amazing five stars across the board stuff, which you can't deny. You know, you'll laugh, you'll cry. It's utter genius. And then there's the middling stuff, which is the worst, because it's kind of, you can see the potential. Yeah, there's potential there, but it's not realised. Or there isn't potential, and they've tried really hard to polish the turd. And that's a fascinating grey area, that stuff in the middle, where, you know, you've got people who were once great and now aren't, or people who will be great but aren't yet, or people who just never will be great and still aren't. But there's this amazing, you know, you have to see the bad stuff to know what not to do. Yeah. And you have to see the good stuff to know where you're going. And I feel the same is true of an artist. Like, if you really want to get to know Paul McCartney, you know, he's a songwriter who often puts up walls and he wears masks by doing pastiche. Like, most of his career, I would argue, has been attempts at pastiche. He just does it really well, you know? Like, I think that's not that controversial a thing to say, is it? I mean, like, you know, in the Beatles, they were doing...
I'm 64, all these old...
Yeah, like, he did,
obla like... Obla-di-obla-da.
Exactly, vaudeville stuff, attempts at sort of reggae or whatever the hell obla-di-obla-da was, you know, sort of Chaz and Dave sort of reggae.
Chaz and Dave
whatever.
Scar.
Yeah. and, like, but he's always done pastiche with aplomb and sort of unselfconsciously just dived into whatever he was doing. But I suppose, you know, in the Beatles, he had John to kind of rein him in a bit, or at least be like, that's not very cool, do something a bit more cool. And he'd be like, oh, okay. You know, sort of check him on lyrical ideas and keep him sharp, keep him on his toes. But yeah, that's not new information that was why the Beatles were so magic. But yeah, but then he did Wings, and that was Wings. And then I suppose the story goes that he was about to tour Japan for a sort of farewell tour with Wings because the band were breaking up, and he took an inadvisably massive amount of weed in his suitcase.
He did.
And were you saying?
I said nothing.
All right, and I didn't say anything either.
No, there were rumours that there was some dope secreted and upon another person in the troop.
I mean, well, good for him, but no, bad for him, because he got locked up in Japan in the airport.
He did.
In a prison cell for like a week or more.
10 days he was.
Ten days, and then he got released.
So 1979, they released Back to the Egg Wings. As they were promoting it, he went home, did this album, knocked it out in a few weeks, I think it was. Then Wings got back together to prepare for the tour.
Right, but crucially, it was out of boredom, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And it was never meant for release.
No.
He made it out of boredom, and he never meant it for release. And he was saying that in the interviews. And, like, somehow the sort of yes men around him...
Yeah.
We're like, no, you should just release it. It's fine. You know. And it wasn't fine. It's really bad.
Well, when you chose this, I was thinking, I thought a few things, but my initial thought was, you know, he's effectively creating something in the same way that you created something. He's just got a home studio.
Yeah, I modelled my career on McCartney. In a way, I have.
There's a lot of parallels.
Well, there's a lot of...
One man creating all of his own music for his own amusement.
Yeah.
And if other people like it, all the better.
Yeah, like, this is McCartney's... Like I was saying, like, if you want to know McCartney the musician, you know, it's hard to, because he puts up all these...
Yeah.
He puts on sort of pastiches and masks, and he writes about non-existent people, or he puts himself in someone else's place and writes from their point of view or whatever. And
yeah.
Yes, as a songwriter, you can't really know him. As a vocalist, it's hard to know him, because he's kind of...
It's a professional sheen.
Yeah,
protection.
Because he's so good. Are you never quite... You know, the rawness of what John Lennon was doing during the 70s, you know, where him and Yoko Ono just kind of shrieking on a stage at points and then just putting that out, you know. And Paul McCartney was never doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
He's never been raw, you know. Towards the end of the Beatles, there was this chasm dividing between... McCartney and Lennon, where, you know, Paul McCartney was writing The Long and Winding Road, and Lennon was not, you know,
doing other
screaming
things.
And spitting vitriol and trying to get to the core truth of who he was. But that never seems to have been something that Paul McCartney's been especially great at, like getting to the core truth of who he is. Like, it's very rare to get those little moments where you're like, that's him, that's the rawest that he is. Like, rawness was never a concern for him, it seems. I don't want to speak for one of the greatest musical geniuses of all time, but
was that because
I don't think that's unfair to say that.
Was that
in my estimation,
he was content?
Yeah, well, I was super rich, sort of achieved a lot, you know, biggest band ever of all time ever.
Yeah, you would be content, wouldn't you, at least?
Yeah.
At the very least.
Yeah,
but then
John problems.
John wasn't.
No, well, he sort of made, you know, well, I mean, he had his own problems, John. He was like, you know, he had a wife that he just sort of estranged, by all accounts. He wasn't that lovely a dude necessarily all the time. And like, so yeah, he had strains in his life, and like, the world was falling apart. It was the 70s, you know, bad things were happening, and he wanted to speak out about them. But Paul McCartney never seemed to be that kind of dude.
No.
You know, so when you have something like McCartney 2, this kind of towering expression of self-absorbed kind of experimentation, it gets us closer to the real McCartney, because you really feel like you're in the studio with him, with him just titting about with a couple of synthesizers.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm selling this album particularly as an experience that most people should have, but I feel like if you're a musician, you owe it to yourself to listen to this. It's a vital part of his yeah.
Cut back to 1979. Wings had just released Back to the Egg. And even as the singles were still coming out, he hid away in his studio, made this. He also made Wonderful Christmas Time during these sessions.
Yeah.
Oddly.
Well, there's like
in July.
There's a few songs he made during that little period which are timelessly classic, brilliant pieces of music. But for some reason, he decided to release all of the stuff he'd been doing. If I released every little experimental thing that I'd ever done as like a compilation of like, this is great. Because I think he was always trying to get back to the feeling of immediacy and effortlessness that he had during the 60s with the Beatles. But you can't reclaim that on your own. Like, it's always interesting when someone who's a part of a band, when you're part of this kind of gestalt entity that is this thing that's more than the sum of its parts. And then as a solo musician, you try to recreate some of that magic. You can't, because you're just a part of what was. And then if you sort of amplify what you are as an individual, it can get very strange and self-indulgent. And yeah. I mean, you like to do a track by track on this, don't you?
Yeah, well, we can get to it. Again, I'm thinking, we were talking about it before, but how after the Beatles split up, what you were saying really, you know, you had the huge arguments and business wrangles with Beatles at Apple. He took solace, he just ran to his studio and made McCartney. And similarly with Wings, they're about to do a huge Japanese tour. And he probably, again, he had his default go to the studio and just make an album. That's for him, just like, you know, having a spliff, I suppose.
Yeah, he was. I think he was smoking a lot of weed at this point. Which can't have
he was. Helped. Well,
weed always makes you think you're slightly more creative than you are.
Yeah.
Sometimes that can be of benefit, but
before he flew to Japan, he phoned John Lennon up because he was stopping off in New York, literally in the apartment over the road from the Dakota, and he phoned John, or he tried to phone John, but Yoko wouldn't put him through, telling John that he'd got some quote dynamite weed and they should hook up, but Yoko didn't want it. So, and there's some
he was trying to be clean at that point, I guess.
I don't know. I'm not going to. I don't.
Right. Okay.
Looking at the timelines,
we shan't speculate.
No, there's a few dodgy authors. There's a guy whose name's nameless. He comes out with a lot of so-called facts, so I don't really want to veer into that. But he implied that the bust in Japan, that someone in Dakota had advised customs that John had Paul had some dynamite weed.
Baseless conspiracy.
Based on this very spurious author.
Really?
Yeah.
He thinks Yoko Ono stopped the...
Yeah.
So we have her to thank for McCartney too.
He was huge. He was huge at the time. He, you know, Coming Up was the number one in America.
Coming Up is an amazing song.
Which starts the album.
Yeah. On like a high note.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really great tune. It's one of those tunes. It's McCartney. You can't not like it. It's just, I mean, you can try and not like it. It's quite a happy little ditty.
Yeah.
But like, you know what I mean? Give it a few bars and you'll be like, oh, I don't mind this.
Yeah. I love
it. Bounces along.
Yeah.
It's fun.
I love that John Lennon heard it. And as always, John never won to give too many compliments away. He said, I heard one track, the hit, Coming Up, which I thought was a good piece of work. Then I heard something else that just sounded like he was depressed. Cheers, John. But yeah, you forget, John heard it. And according to Paul, that inspired him then to create Double Fantasy and get back in the studio.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, so that's the first track on the album is Coming
Up.
And it starts really promisingly. It's strong, just comes in, and it's got this really interesting kind of sort of bedroom sound to it. Like, a lot of people are quite influenced by this. Like, the dudes from Hot Chip are really influenced by it. And so, like, anyone who's like into that kind of, it sounds like one person in a room just arsing around with instruments. But like, no, yeah, Coming Up's an amazing track. And but then it kind of goes on a bit too long, and then it kind of slows down, and that's a weird way to end a pop track. And then you'll be listening to it being like, oh, that was interesting. Maybe there was a lack of editorial control here. And then it becomes glaringly obvious that he's just been sitting in his room for ages making stuff. But it's so odd that this is how he would have his life. I think maybe he thought he was doing what Bowie had done in Berlin or what Lennon had done, you know, with Yoko Ono screeching over noise music, you know. Maybe he was like, this is my experimental album. This is what I want to do. It's the real me, and people are telling me it's good. Because it's so promising
It starts off incredibly promising, doesn't it?
Yeah, and like you say, like he Wonderful Christmas Time was made during this sort of time, and he was clearly messing around with synthesizers and really getting to know the studio himself. What more is there to say about coming up? Well, I suppose there was
the video.
Yeah,
which
was
debuted on the Kenny Everett Video Show.
Yeah, I've got a record.
I'll put it on the website.
Yeah, it's framed on my wall. It's Kenny Everett's The World's Worst Record Show Ever, and it's a very precious record to me for the same reason that this one is. It's just, you have to listen to bad music or you will repeat the mistakes that haven't been made throughout history.
Is that the one with Transfusion?
Isn't it? Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's like 20 of the worst ever songs, I think.
Yeah.
It's stunning. But Bowie was into that, though. Bowie was really into the legendary Stardust Cowboy.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Who just, it's so bad. It's such bad music. I love bad music. But bad music is bad for so many reasons. Like a few of my friends are also into, like, really bad music for the same reasons that I am. It's just, it's fascinating. In fact, there's a whole subreddit, and one of them is crappy music. / crappy music. It's just full of just bad music because there's a fascination about it. You're like, someone saw this through to the end and then thought, this is good. I'll play it to other people.
Yeah.
And there's something fascinating about that.
Yeah.
That you'd have an idea, see it through to its conclusion, and it's just a bad, either the idea was bad or your execution of it was bad or both. But you didn't think so.
Yeah.
And it's obvious to the rest of the world.
He would have had nobody there really to say, no, Paul, no.
It's weird. Like, surely even his wife or like his friends would have been like, "Dude, this is a bad idea." But then maybe they did, and he was like, "No, I'm going to do this. It's the real me. It's the me in the studio." I mean, the interviews at the time would suggest that he was very pleased with it.
Yeah, and originally, as we were discussing the other day, it was going to be a double album.
Yeah,
and I think if you're
that's hard, that ruined my day having to listen to the whole.
You listened to the whole thing.
It's really
wow.
Bad. It's like what is it? 2 45-minute sides.
Yeah.
It's painful. It's like watching your... As a Beatles fan, listening to that, the whole of McCartney 2, the unedited version, is like... It's like walking in on your parents and then being forced to wait until your dad's finished.
It's just like that, isn't it?
It really is. It's you just... There's moments where, you know... An idea will start really promisingly, and then he'll start doing something. You're just, oh no, Paul, don't. Just stop. Make it stop. Then it goes on for another 4 minutes. I've never walked into my parents.
Please don't. Please don't.
But I imagine that this is what it would feel like.
Yeah.
This is probably their record that they like to get jiggy to.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's not Dad. I didn't mean that. Sorry.
I won't use that.
It's probably ELO.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, let's move on.
Let's move on. I won't use that. Just in case there's every chance they could hear that, I won't use it.
Oh no, they'll hear it anyway.
Oh, they will.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's fine. I'm not abashed about my parents getting it on. If they hadn't done it, I wouldn't be here to tell the tale.
We wouldn't be
I'm
here.
Delighted
now
that they have
talking about like this very moment. That's what it was for. So you can bore and talk about this album.
I don't know if there's anything you could actually get it onto on this album because, I mean, what have we got? Coming up, you can't.
Bogey music.
You can't do it to that. Bogey music. Boom, bogey music. With the, it sounds like Vic Reeves doing it.
It's
and then like, and he's put this delay on it that totally ruins it. If he'd left the delay off, it might be a nice little funny, jokey, pastiche, rock and roll ditty. But again, he ruins it. Every track has promise and then gets ruined, with the exception of Coming Up. Everyone has a failed, brilliant idea. Temporary Secretary. What an experience.
Mm.
It's so bad. It's so bad.
Is it so bad?
It's so bad.
Is it really so
bad? Well, no, because, right, like, so the reason I know about this album at all is because a fair few years ago, me and my my good mate Johnny, who is a techno obsessive, right? He's like a you know, he was there when techno was being created and... Yeah. Became massive, and he's a techno survivor, you know. He was there in like 1989. He loves Temporary Secretary because it's like proto techno. It's 1980, and he's got this sequencer running, and you're like, oh, that's cool. If you're a techno head, you'll be like, that's it, mate. That's it. Come on. Bring in the kick. I can't wait for the drop. Yeah. And then he starts playing with a bunch of sort of, you know, reverb sends and stuff. And you're like, oh, okay, interesting. Oh, there's a guitar. That's weird. That doesn't quite work. And then he starts singing, and he's got this really weird, Mr. Marsh, can you hear me? You're like, oh, not that again. And before you know it, the lyrics are very bad. Very bad. It's so bad. Everything about it's terrible, apart from the first four bars, which are just a sequencer, which were probably just completely random.
Yeah.
It's so bad. And it's interesting, because it's kind of... the whole thing's like a troll. So if you play it to like a techno head, like if you put it on at an after party, everyone will start moving to the synthesizer at the start.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, everyone will be like... dude, what is this? I don't like it. It's weird. It's bugging me out. What is this? And because what's he talking about? He's written a song about... who writes lyrics about needing a temporary...
well, Mr.
secretary?
Marks was... there was a...
it's an agency.
Agent, Alfred
secretary
Marks.
Secretary agency.
Alfred Marks.
But that's not clear. Do you think he's talking about, like, maybe, you know, Karl Marx? Or
Karl Marx? Like, wow, that
I always assumed that's what he was talking about, and he was trying to make some big statement. It's very weird.
Yeah.
It's a bad idea. But it's weird, because obviously he's got this equipment, and it's really interesting equipment. And maybe he's been listening to some Kraftwerk or maybe some Throbbing Gristle. I don't know.
Yeah.
But because he's a songwriting genius, he can't help himself but write songs. And
even when he's trying deliberately not to, the musician in him.
But I don't think he had a plan. Like, if he'd have gone in with a plan that was like, I'm not going to write a single song, I'm not going to sing a single note, I'm not going to do a single chord change, or I'm not going to modulate, or I'm only going to modulate, whatever, if he'd have set himself a goal to be like, this is the remit artistically for this album, and it's going to be different qualitatively from everything I've done before, and if he had someone kind of advising, someone who was sort of in that experimental world, but he didn't, so he had no plan, he had no one to tell him no, and then he had a record company biting his heels saying, here's material, you should release it. So we have this gift, gift of this McCartney at his absolute worst, his magic.
Or best, depending on how you view it. But why?
No.
Why?
No.
I view it like this.
No. Well, no, it was right, so...
don't you think that the fact he released it at all, when he was absolutely huge, it's like, I don't know, Kanye West or whoever, you know, some...
oh, yeah, there's parallels.
Big. Or... take that back in the day. Imagine them suddenly coming out with, you know, who's the lead singer? Gary Barlow.
Yeah. If Gary Barlow released like a Gabba record, or like a breakcore, just techno.
Yeah.
I'd listen to Gary Barlow trying to make techno, but he'd probably have the same problem. Not enough experience in listening to that sort of music and being into that sort of music. Like, you know, I'm very often sort of tasked with making a particular kind of music, and I'm not an expert at that kind of music, so... I'll try and kind of acknowledge that. Like, Bowie was really good at that. He would go in and do pastiche, but he'd do it in his own way, and he'd make sure that what he was doing was cool.
Yeah.
And he would honour the originators of the music by not trying to get too close to what they were doing, keeping his own accent, he'd keep his own vibe. So, you know, like, Bowie in the mid-70s was starting to sound more like Anthony Newley and Scott Walker than his sort of Ziggy incarnation, which was much more kind of like, you know, and he ended up being like, so he was literally changing his vocal tone, and at the same time he was copying soul, and those kind of tones aren't necessarily associated with that, so he was always making these odd combinations of things and keeping it his own. But that's not what Paul McCartney was doing here, and I think maybe he kind of thought, I'm Paul McCartney, I'm really good, whatever I do will be great. And that's that for me is the core lesson from this. Never rest on your laurels. Never just say, I'll do something, it will be fine. Always be thinking, what is the uninitiated listener going to think of this? What time am I living in? What other music is out there? What's my vertical, you could say? What's the what is the genre in which I operate?
Wouldn't he have been confused, though, because he would have released Coming Up, which was a number one in America. Wouldn't he have then thought, yep, that's it, this album's going to work? And he still had people saying, you know, even if they did tell him no, he said, well, Coming Up was just number one. Let's just release the album.
Yeah, he might have really wanted this to happen. He might have wanted a break from from what Wings were and what the Beatles were, and he was keen to throw himself into the... I mean, I don't know, but, like, it could be that. It could be that he wanted to disrupt his own career deliberately. Like, Stuart Lee does that all the time with every set he does. He says he deliberately puts himself in danger and tries to crawl out. Brian Eno would advocate for that sort of thing. Mm. I'm sure there's a couple of oblique strategies that Brian Eno would... I can't remember everything that's in that deck. Brian Eno made a deck of cards called Oblique Strategies that... Yeah. That inform lots of his kind of experimental genius. Mm. You know, what tricky ways to get yourself out. But Paul McCartney could have done with that. Like, one of those cards, one of the oblique strategies is leave the studio for a sec, listen to it through a shut door.
Yeah.
All these little things to jolt you out of climbing up your own arse.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah.
Never fun. On the way, track three.
On the way. Boring, blues. Boring, pastiche, blues, not about anything particularly specific. Again, with this wildly out of time delay.
Yes.
It's very sparse. It's got a sparseness which would be refreshing if there was other content in the music to really grip you. But there sort of isn't, so it ends up being a bit bland and a bit nothing. And it maybe sounds like he was trying to get back to a rawness of the early rock and roll beginnings that he came from. Because let's not forget, like, that was his musical upbringing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously he had loads of influences, but, like, you know, when he was a kid and the Beatles were becoming the biggest thing in the universe, that was what the zeitgeist was. Yeah. So I guess it's very hard to remove yourself from that once you're, you know, your environment of musical evolutionary adaptation is, you know, those precious years between, like, what, 11 and 18 or something, and that's when you're sort of cast into the mould of the world that you're in. But, like, yeah, it's really boring. it's a really boring track.
But eloquently put.
Yeah, thanks. It's rubbish.
Yeah. However. However, moving on. Waterfalls. Oh, God, I know what I think about this. What do you think
about it?
I love it. I
think really?
Possibly one of the best. One of the best songs he's ever
written. Don't let me ruin it for you.
No, you go for it.
It gets us closer to the real McCartney. But I feel like it's almost him telling himself not to do this. He's piling into all this, you know, studio experimentation and synthesizers, and then this song is about staying where it's safe.
Mm.
And it's almost like there's a part of Paul McCartney trying to say, dude, stop. This is a terrible idea. Stick with what you know. Don't do it. So in that respect, I suppose it's quite nice. And it inspired, was it TLC? Who did
that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't go chasing waterfalls. It's very beautiful. But
you're saying about you never quite find out the real Paul McCartney.
Mm.
This is one of his honest ones, because I would say,
yeah, definitely.
You know, I need love. Clearly he needs love. He's always on tour.
He does, but he should have rewritten some of the lyrics, because, like, he said in this interview in 1980, he was like,
I was writing about Don't Go Chasing Polar Bears because I thought it suited the...
It fit, you know. So often he would write... Paul McCartney tends to write music first and then fits words into it.
Yeah.
You know, if he'd have kept Yesterday as Scrambled Eggs, it would not be a classic. Waterfalls probably would, in my opinion, would have been a better tune if he hadn't have talked about polar bears taking you. But there is something cute about it. I don't know. It is what it is.
Yeah.
It's Don't Go Chasing Polar Bears. It's a very weird thing to put in.
But
song.
Very
but
wise.
Maybe it makes it. Maybe it's all about chasing polar bears. I mean, look, he's a genius, right? Like, Paul McCartney is a genius. Like, he dreams songs in their entirety.
Mm.
I don't know of anyone else who has that happen to them.
No.
That's how amazing he is.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, like if you want to know Paul McCartney the artist, Neil Young had this songwriting policy, which was a no edits policy. You had to just write the first thing down that came into your head, and if it makes sense, great. If it doesn't, whatever. But that's the artistically true thing.
Mm.
So, yeah, maybe it's a bit twee talking about polar bears, or it's like an odd thing to put in a song up to that point. It's been very kind of earnest, but it's a weird metaphor. He probably could have done with a different metaphor, but
yeah.
Yeah, that's the first thing that came out of his head. Maybe that's just beautiful. Mm. It doesn't have to be a reason. It just fits. Polar bears.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm a genius. I'll keep it in.
Next, we had, again, The Voice, Nobody Knows, in this voice he uses a lot, the Nobody Knows.
It's just him in the studio doing the easiest, most boring thing he can possibly do. Just a bit of, rock and roll shouting through no one cares about that. Fine, that's your kind of please, by all means, get to know the studio. Learn how the equipment works. Do some rubbish rock and roll for your own amusement. Play it in your car. Don't bother us with it. But again, if you want to know the real Paul McCartney, if you
there
want to feel
is.
Like
there
you're in the studio with Paul McCartney, it's brilliant. If you want to know how he ticks, what he's like when he's just unrestrained jamming, there is something to that. They've released loads of outtakes and demos from all the biggest Beatle albums.
Mm.
Let's hear the rest of these sessions. Let's hear the stuff that he left behind. Mm. This is that. It's like that period where he was making tunes like Wonderful Christmas Time, which are kind of really sort of inventive synth pop for 1980. Mm. And this was the workings out.
Yes.
Teachers always want to see how you worked out
absolutely,
the answer. This is how.
Yeah. And the answer was?
The answer was, see me.
We move over to side two, and starting with an instrumental, Front Parlour. Just think of the look around you theme.
Me, 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 me. So this is a perfect example of what happens when a songwriting genius tries not to be one but can't help it. He's experimenting with synthesizers, he's listening to Kraftwerk, he's banging out a tune, and it's a happy, funny little ditty.
Yeah.
And it's... oh man, it's so long and nothing happens in it.
It was recorded. He's got little anecdotes about all of these songs.
Has he?
His anecdote about this one, it was recorded in the front parlour, so I called it Front Parlour.
Brilliant. That's so Paul McCartney. That's
it's
very
so Paul
McCartney.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it just happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but again, great, you've made it. Fantastic.
Mm.
Good for you. I don't know. This is terrible. I'm going to get so much hate for all this.
No,
let me just make it abundantly clear.
I defy anybody.
Paul McCartney is a genius. He's a songwriting genius. But you wouldn't. Would you go to a museum where he'd put all every poo he'd ever taken on a plate and
probably. I probably would.
Oh.
Moving on to the Summer's Day song.
Summer's Day song.
Yeah.
So this one is interesting because it's kind of similar to Wazza Hazzawazza, or however you're supposed to pronounce it, from Low by Bowie.
Yes.
Yeah. Very similar kind of, yeah, very similar instrumentation, timbre and tempo and kind of vibe, but it's terrible. Because Bowie had darkness in him, and any darkness that's in Paul McCartney, he kind of seems to skim off like a stone. Like even in his recent album, you can hear that he's trying to connect with the tragedy that's happened in his life and with the sadness that he feels, but he can't bring himself to. And I don't think it's because he's afraid to go there. I think it's because the music in him doesn't really want to. He's just like, he bounces off of his sadness and skims like a stone, and that's beautiful. And that's what seems to happen on this. It's like flirting with depth and musically, it's kind of, I mean, maybe it's only because it sounds like it's going to be by Bowie that I'm then expecting it to have those same levels of kind of depth and I suppose otherworldliness. But then it very quickly turns into something that sounds like a sort of alternative national anthem.
Yeah.
Which is just not the vibe, is it? I mean, if you're on a summer's day and then you start hearing this, it's kind of, there's an element of kind of the psychedelia of some of the sort of.
Yeah. The very first
'60s Beatles stuff
is almost Strawberry Fields, isn't it? The very first.
Yeah, well, the Beatles often flirted with bringing sort of overly pompous big band music into their music to kind of, I don't know, sort of throw their music into sharp relief, or maybe to kind of just highlight how absurd all this pomp is and stuff. And they kind of contextualized that sort of element of life that way. But this doesn't do that. It kind of, he brings in these kind of big, sort of overimportant sounding chords. And just let them be. Let it be. Just let it be. Yeah, it sucks.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to make you love this album. Frozen Jap.
Now. Oh my god, it's so bad. It's so bad. The title, racist. And then I first heard this song, a few years ago, and was really hoping that this was the point at which the album was going to sort of pick up and it was going to find its flow experimentally. And then it's just the same thing, the same sort of 8 bars happening for 4 minutes. That's the crucial thing about this song. It's 4 minutes long. Nearly 4 minutes, anyway.
Yeah.
It should be 30 seconds. It should have been a skit track, and then it'd be really cool.
Yeah.
And he should have changed the title. But again, like, I've seen him in an interview saying, he was like, yeah, well, you know, it was a working title, Frozen Jap, and I thought, I'll call it something else, but I didn't. Just decided, you know, that was what came to me.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the remit for this. Maybe it was, I'm not going to change a thing.
Yeah. And it worked. If that was the remit that he produced.
Well, yeah. He did it.
100% success.
He did it.
And John, during the White Album sessions, when he was presenting John with the lyrics for Hey Jude, there was the line, was that the movement on your shoulder? And Paul was saying, I'll change that. And John was, no, you won't. That's a brilliant line. He seems to have taken that on board for the rest of his career. It seems to be the first thing that comes into his head. Yeah, I'll use that.
There's something in that. Like, if you've been a member of the biggest band of all time, and you've got this incessant rivalry with your bandmate, and you know there's this sort of acrimonious split, and you want to prove to yourself, your own self-confidence, that you can do it alone, and you don't want to have to feel that you are second guessing yourself all the time, that you need someone there to help to save you from yourself. So maybe this was a kind of an affirmation, an act of personal affirmation for Paul McCartney, that he needed to know that he could just trust his instincts and not be too cerebral about things. Or he was just really stoned. One of the two. Maybe both.
Yeah. bogey music inspired by the Raymond Briggs Fungus the Bogeyman stories. Yeah.
I mean, it's terrible. It's a terrible thing.
Does it not?
Bogey music.
It's the Vic Reeves with a delay that's out of time, yeah. And uninventive 12-bar blues. I will say one thing about every single thing on this album. The fact that he self-produced it and there wasn't even a mixing desk and he just stuck all the mics straight into the back of it and he was, you know, banging drums in his own toilet to get the sort of sound that he wanted and stuff like that. It sounds great.
Yeah.
Like, if you forget the music, just listen to the sonics, it's really interesting.
You prefer the recipe to the actual dish.
Yeah, all good things have gone into it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, using all the best ingredients. But that's the thing with all of these tracks. Like, they're just, all good things have gone into it. And, like, were he to have removed some of the stuff? Like, that's all that Rick Rubin does, apparently. He goes into things where he knows that the artists that he's working with are just there, ripe, ready to make the best thing in their career. And he just goes in and tells them not to do half the stuff they were going to do. He's like, no, don't do that. Just leave it raw. Like, yeah. I was hanging out with Ed Sheeran years ago before he became, like, massively huge. And it was when he was just about to do his second album. And Rick Rubin came to visit him. And he paid him his day rate to come and, like, advise. And apparently the advice he gave him was, don't change a thing. He was like, don't you think...
How much did he charge for that advice?
I think it's like $1,000 a day or something, which is pretty good.
I could have said that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever you're doing, carry on.
Yeah. But like...
Here's my invoice.
It must have been more than $1,000 a day. I don't know if I've misremembered that. I just made it up. I mean, it's Rick Rubin, you know.
Yeah.
Like, if you get him in the studio, he'll stroke his beard and then magic will happen and then he'll sell quintillion records. No, but that was the advice he gave him, which was like, strip it back. You know, you're basically a cafe musician who also happens to be a genius. Keep the looper, keep the guitar, add nothing. And, you know, cut to like a few years later and he's playing three nights at Wembley Stadium with just a guitar and a looper and changed nothing, which is the boldest, biggest baller move of all time. So yeah, if Rick Rubin had been there or someone of that sort,
absolutely,
you know, to say, this is very nice, Paul, but here's what you should just take away. Don't put that crazy delay on your voice. You don't need it. Rewrite that one lyric there. Leave that song off the album. So to be honest, what he was doing, like, it was sounding like he was doing something really interesting. He could have kept going on this tip and kept a few of the songs. There's one song that actually didn't make it onto this album, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute once we've gone through all the tracks, that genuinely is brilliant. And he didn't put it on.
Oh, Paul. Next, we have Darkroom.
Ugh. Well, so if he wasn't singing on it, it would be really cool. So this... Wait, which is the track that starts with... What? Which one's that?
It's Bogey Wobble.
Wait, Bogey Wobble. Wait, there's one more thing I need to say about Bogey Wobble. Right, so Bogey Wobble...
which you do very well.
What? That is kind of like, so he was deep in the studio playing around with these synths, and occasionally he would hit on something, like, because he was so uncensored and explorative, he would sometimes hit on something that would eventually be a whole genre. That's like, what? That's really cool. That's really cool synthesis. Like, it's very basic, but like, that's the whole of dubstep, you know? So like, he sort of chanced upon that. And in Darkroom, he's sounds like he's sped up the drums.
Yes, yeah.
And that kind of anticipates jungle. So it sounds like a jungle break because he's kind of doing this kind of syncopated sort of funky drum break, which he sped up to double speed and put over a kind of slow, plodding, there's this sort of dark, you know, dark, dubby, ploddy kind of almost hip-hop-like sort of sparseness to the to the drums, and then he's got this double speed snare going over the top. It's badass. It's really cool. And then he starts singing about a bloody dark room and ruins it. It was going so well. He was anticipating genres, being ahead of his time. And then he's like imploring you to step inside his dark room, which is just creepy.
Yeah.
What are you going to do to me, Paul, in your dark room? It smells of chemicals. Let me out, Paul. It's really bad.
Yeah.
So again, brilliant idea. Show's promise, ruins it.
Yeah. And it's edited down. This is the edited down version. There's a longer version as well. But I love his little voice he does at the end. Sped up.
Yeah.
If you claw away, there's some little diamond.
Yeah, if you took the... I think a few of these tracks, if you took the vocals off... Because he does a lot of these kind of like silly voices, which... I like silly voices. I'm a big fan, but time and a place, you know. It's like I like curry. I like having sex, but
not at
the same time. You know,
it's almost if you took off coming up temporary secretary and waterfalls, and put on some of the other crazy stuff, it could almost be like a comedy album.
Paul McCartney's first and only comedy album. Brilliant.
I'm taking a new direction.
Oh, when my feet are on the ground, I'm gonna look around and see what's right, see what's there, and breathe fresh air ever after.
So we end with the haunting, shall we say, One of These Days.
Well, One of These Days is song. That is an amazing track. So like, yeah, it's amazing, and it kind of... Yeah, I guess this album is bookended by two brilliant tracks. It's wistful, and it's yearning, and it kind of hints at this kind of wider world and sort of great realizations that are yet to come and sort of waiting to be settled and have peace of mind, which again is this kind of, you know, it's in antithesis to a lot of the experimentation that's on the album. So that in itself is beautiful, that he's like, I'm going to go all the way out there and experiment as much as I can musically and technologically, which is still not very far. But yeah, then he sort of reins it back in. He's like, one of these days I'll really find myself and be myself. And that's kind of what he's been trying to do. So in that sense, it's beautiful. It's complete as a piece of work. Just don't listen to it, for God's sake. Like, if you want... It's like Schindler's List, you know? It's there. It's a piece of art. It's a vital piece of work. But you've got to clear your day if you want to watch that. You might have to clear your week. You won't be quite the same. It will ruin your week. But it's there. It's art. Maybe that's what all good art should be. Confrontational, to make you question what you thought
Absolutely.
You knew. Maybe it's his best work.
The album cover itself is very striking.
It's just him looking like like he realizes what he's done. He's like, oh God, no! I've released it. Oh, everyone's listening to it. I can't take it back. Shit! That's his face on the front cover of this album.
It's all in the eyes.
Yeah. It's like, oh no. There's dread, like a utter dread. And it looks like he's saying, oh shit. Like, his mouth always looks a bit like that because he's Paul McCartney. He's kind of mouth. But like this, he looks particularly worried. It's like a mugshot.
It is, which
maybe
is weird, because this would have come out after he'd been arrested in Japan. I wonder if it was a play on that.
Maybe this album cover was his first idea, and he just went with it.
Yeah,
because he had to go with his first idea.
Originally, it was going to be a double album. There's a few tracks on there that didn't quite make it. They were released as B-sides and that sort of thing. Check My Machine. I do like that. I think that's a great song.
Check My Machine, yeah. I quite like it in a weird way, because it's not unlistenably bad. Like, it's a kind of awful that it's quite entertaining.
a warm.
Check. My machine. Like, it is annoying. Yeah, it's very annoying, but kind of funny. Like, in the same way that, like, my 4.5-year-old will sometimes be excruciatingly annoying, but, like, you've got to laugh.
Yeah.
Because he's cute. It's the same kind of thing. Yeah. He's doing this cute little bunny voice over, like, a reggae beat. You're like, Paul, mate, what are you doing? But it's kind of like being tickled. You're like, oh, you silly baby, Paul.
Oh, you.
You silly man. Oh my God, all you horse riders.
Oh,
I want to kick Paul. Is that what you've written as your note? Do you know what I mean? But again, the instrumentation underneath it is really interesting.
Yeah.
And then he starts going, all you horse riders, doing like your dad doing a generic foreign accent kind of racist kind of voice. What accent is it supposed to be?
I don't know.
Just generally.
I'm
sure
like
Paul's not racist, but like.
It sounds like.
This voice is a racist voice. It's, oh God. Yeah, and by the time, it's impossible to listen to more than 2 minutes of this song. Really tried.
I did. Did I write
and
that?
And I'm a connoisseur of bad music, and I can't get through it.
I was playing it last
night. It made me so angry trying to listen to it. I was like, I couldn't get through it.
I was playing that song last night, and I was thinking, you know, you sort of question your life. Right, I'll give it a minute. No, I'm never going to get that back. And yeah,
this is from the guy that wrote Eleanor Rigby.
I know.
Like even like No More Lonely Nights, which is like the cheesiest, most saccharine, like meaningless love song of all time, which came after this.
Mm.
Even that is like amazing compared to it's so bad. Maybe if he still got the multi tracks from it, maybe someone can sort of strip it back the way they did with some of the other Beatles albums.
Yoko's had a ridiculous number of American dance single number ones, like 20-odd, and it's people grabbing her old songs from the 70s, putting a dance beat on them. She's one of the most successful dance acts in America, in the US. Check it out on Google.
It must be 2018. That doesn't make any sense. That's insane. Mr. H. Atom, you've written Shangri-Las versus the Village People.
Did I?
I see that, yeah. Yeah, it's got a kind of... Wait, let me refresh my memory.
Shangri-Las versus the Village People. Oh, right, he actually says it at the beginning.
So, that's as far as I got, probably. So this is primarily Linda.
Oh, it's so shit. Again, all good things have gone into it. Like,
you've got all the ingredients.
You know, Kobe beef and double cream and jelly. And
a dab of butter.
Just
a dab.
Yeah, cinnamon.
Delicious. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, salads and just, you know, I don't know, it's a terrible analogy. But like, yeah, all good things have gone into it. But they don't work together. He shouts.
Yeah.
Research has suggested or something.
Yeah.
That the difference between a man and a woman is just a single atom. Hydrogen.
Yeah.
Mr. H. Atom. And you're left thinking, what? And then he goes... I'll
write a song about it.
Yeah. Mr. H. Atom lives in a flat on... What are you talking about? Shut up. Just play the song. It's a great little... Like, the music's great.
Mm.
It's really interesting. And, like, it's kind of that new wavy...
Yeah.
Kind of urgent kind of disco thing.
It's a B-52s-esque Talking Heads...
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of feeling about it.
But what are you chatting about, Paul? Rein it in, mate. Rein your neck in. That was wise, leaving that one off. Blue Suede is a beautiful track because it's all... Maybe it was just the choice not to sing on it. Mm. Maybe he just hit that... I think on Blue Suede, he hit the point that he was trying to, in my opinion, with this project, where he was kind of... He managed to make something that had depth and emotion to it. It was very sort of evocative and powerful sounding and hit at... emotions and feelings, and it feels like it feels like it has a kind of color to it because it is just a kind of sound painting. There are no real sort of major chord changes or lyrical ideas that he maybe felt that he should put on all these others. And it's really gorgeous. And I think if he'd have, if someone had said to him, mate, that's the vibe, like that's what you should be doing, and make more, do more, you're onto a good thing. These were terrible, but now you're onto a good thing, keep going, release it in 1981. But no, but again, at the end of Blue Suede, he goes, oh, okay, I'm bored of this now, and then speeds it up.
Yeah.
And the speed up itself is kind of awkward and feels like a sort of drummer falling over himself, which maybe is actually what happened in the studio. Who knows? Because he would often first lay down the drum track. And then he sort of carried on playing and ruins it. So, yeah, you can't get it onto that either.
No. Another track that wasn't released on the album but did make it as a B-side of Temporary Secretary, The Secret Friend.
Yeah, when I first started listening to this, I thought it was another failed experiment because it's got these very sort of jarring key changes, but I think it's a grower. I think it's actually a brilliant piece of work. It's got these kind of drum machine-y, sort of early drum machine sort of lounge elements to it. It's kind of calypso beat, and... this sort of arpeggiation on the synth is really nice. It's really nice. It is really nice. Sonically, it's kind of slightly jarring. But yeah, so I think maybe he hit his experimental stride on this slightly. Like, the vocals aren't too obtrusive. It works. I think it works.
Yeah.
I mean, which is a rare thing for this little period of his
In the context of releasing... I mean, this was only, Temporary Secretary was only released as a 12-inch with that on the B-side, which is like 10 minutes. That was a... Don't you think that's an incredibly brave thing to release from one of the world's greatest artists?
Bravery and folly, very closely folly, related. Yeah. No, but again, so this Secret Friend track is, it's very cool. It should have been 2.5 minutes long. Yeah. 10 minutes long. So, like, you can't, again, you try and get to the end of any of these songs and you can't. But you can guarantee that by the end of the song, he's fucked it up.
I think at the beginning of them, you love him. And by the end of each song, you just hate him so much.
Yeah, you're like, Paul, stop, for God's sake. He's just running over the same dog again and again. He's running over your family dog, your first ever family pet, Paul McCartney, reversing over it angrily again and again in his Jaguar.
On that, on that note.
Whilst your parents have sex and you're forced to watch.
On that note, overall, this album that you chose.
yeah.
Which, I've failed to sell the idea to you. Well, I think...
Blue Suede is great. I would keep that in my collection, but I think I would truncate the end.
Yeah.
What are your fade overall, it out before the speed up.
What are your overall thoughts, positive thoughts, if possible, on this?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know... I
love this album.
Do you
I
really?
Love the album.
Do you genuinely love
I
it?
Genuinely
so
love
you don't
it.
Feel that it's bad at all. The songs are bad.
I feel parts of it I did want to kick him. But most of it, it's just like,
you're very forgiving, that's lovely.
As a Beatles fan, some of the crap that we have to buy, you know, the outtakes and whatever, and you can appreciate snippets of them chatting away in the studio, and taken on that level, it's just like a little work in progress that he had the balls to actually release it. You know, it was
the folly
to release it.
And I think mostly that.
I think there's some great, you know, coming up, Temporary Secretary, Waterfalls. Waterfalls, as I say, is for me one of his
Waterfalls, you're welcome to. You can have that one.
I mean, Waterfalls is a track that I think is... I think with all of this stuff, it's like a lot of music that comes out is worth listening to as a piece of art and as a transformative process for you as an artist, as a soul, as a musician. I don't really care how wanky that sounds because it's true. Yeah. You need to listen to stuff that challenges you and you need to listen to stuff that's there for research purposes. So like where there are alternative takes of recordings of songs that you know well, that's worth listening to. Where there are interviews, they're worth listening to. Where there are like different instrumentations of like all the Zeppelin albums, they've got these special editions now where you can hear outtakes and alternative versions and the workings out. And some of Lennon's 70s stuff, they've now re-released some of the more raw, stripped back kind of first takes.
Yeah,
I've been listening obsessively to them because they're brilliant, you know. And you get you get that closeness to the artist that you love. And in this day and age, there's a lot of that generally. Like, if you follow an artist, you'll follow them on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, whatever, because you want to be close to them and you want to know how they're doing it. So someone like Deadmau5, you know, he's a contemporary kind of entity. He's a, you know, prog house dude, all very electronic. He doesn't really play any instruments. But he, the finished product is beautiful and is what it is. And he shows the working out.
Yeah.
Like he's on. He's doing live streams, making tunes, and you can know an artist now. Like it, time was, you know, back in McCartney's day when this was coming out, you couldn't really know an artist. There were fanzines. You would fish around for scraps of whatever it was they were making. These days, every artist that you follow, you know their every thought. You know, so to be an artist in 2018, you're an entity that just does stuff and says stuff as much as you are someone that puts out music.
Mm.
You're sort of present in the culture. Just because you have a thought and you share it with the world, and that's that there is no veil of secrecy anymore. Like, it's very rare that you get an artist like that. There are some, but they're the exception. So something like this is, well, so as a result, you know, you'll find yourself listening to some music that you're never going to listen to again, especially in this new streaming reality that we live in. For there to be a classic album is a rare thing, but because streaming is the way it works now, music is transitory and kind of ephemeral and doesn't exist in physical form. And you know, that's causing this kind of vinyl fetishism to come back where people are buying physical objects because they want to be able to hold this experience. They don't want it to just evaporate as soon as it's finished. So I guess my point is, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. Like, as a thing to have listened to, you've got, if you are a Beatles fan, this is a vital piece of art that you have to have consumed. But would you listen to it again? That's the question. Yeah, like, what, yeah. So the only one I listen to is the Blue Suede,
which isn't on the
Blue Suede, which isn't on the album. No, but that said, coming up, I think that's an amazing track. And One of These Days, that's an amazing track. And the live version of Coming Up, his voice is in fine form. Yeah. And you know, and he sounds like he's got a really sore throat, but he still never misses a note. It's amazing. He's so pro. It's incredible. You know, there's a reason he's this successful. You know, it's not by accident. But this album was. It's the only chance you get to hear Paul McCartney just having accidents in the studio. And there's something to be said for that.
There is. Beardy Man, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I'm going to persist, folks. The mic's going off, and I'm going to bash it into him to love this album.
He's going to physically.
I am.
Yeah. You can't make me.
All right.
No, I accept that it is a beautiful thing.
Thank you so much for your time. To keep in touch with all of our other podcasts, go to our website, iamtheeggpod.com, or follow us on Twitter at iamtheeggpod. Thank you very much.
Cheers.